With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, the state of the farm safety net is deemed unsustainable in a recent report. We'll have more on that, but our top story today. The USDA has finalized a rule to align the voluntary product of the U.S. label claim with consumer understanding of what that claim means. U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack made the announcement Monday at the National Farmers Union Annual Convention in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Now, I came to you last year and indicated that we were going to take a look at trying to create some consistency and transparency and predictability in terms of labeling. I told you we had a proposed rule, product of the USA. We received 3,300 comments about that rule. Today, we're filing that final rule that was announced. We're encouraging adoption of that rule as quickly as possible. There's an extended period of time before formal implementation, but we are now on record as being for the utilization of that label only when the animal is born, raised, slaughtered, and processed in the U.S. We were also basically saying, now you can't get by with the slapping an American flag on the package unless the animal is born, raised, slaughtered, and processed in the U.S.
He said the rule will prohibit misleading U.S. origin labeling in the market and help ensure that the information that consumers receive about where their food comes from is truthful.
The reason for this is quite simple. We surveyed consumers. We asked them the question, when you see this label, what do you think it means? They said, well, what do you mean? It means everything was done in the United States. Well, actually, that's not been the case. Then we asked the question, do you place a value on that? I mean, in other words, are you willing to pay a nickel or two more if that is on the list? Well, absolutely. We want to help our farmers. So in order for that value proposition to be respected, in order for there to be fairness and honesty and a proper representation in the marketplace, it's important to have rules like this.
Secretary Vilsack also made two other announcements. First, USDA is awarding $9.5 million to 42 projects through the Local Meat Capacity Grant Program to expand processing options for the meat and poultry industry. Second, there are new actions to ensure transparency and a fair and competitive market in the U.S. seed industry.
We're also focusing as well on the issue of seed. As you know, we had a seed report. The seed report came back and said, look, first and foremost, there has to be a better relationship between the Department of Agriculture and the United States Patent and Trade Office. And because far too often, folks are getting patents extended or granted, and it makes it harder for producers' voices to be heard in that process. It makes it harder for researchers to be able to have the germplasm to be able to create alternatives and new opportunities and more choice and more competition. So we established the Farmer Seed Liaison Program, and we're now providing that farmer voice into that process. We think it creates greater transparency. We think it creates potentially more competition and hopefully lower costs for farmers. We also think that there is a Federal Seed Act and that people ought to comply with the Federal Seed Act. So novel idea.
Novel thought.
Novel idea. And so the question is, what is happening out there in the marketplace? You know, there's a lot of information that's available on the web. And there is a tendency on the part of all of us to say, well, I read it on the internet, so it's kind of got to be true, right? Well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. So we're announcing today a website monitoring program where we're going to hire specialists who are specialists in understanding the intricacies of the Federal Seed Act, and we're tasking them with doing a very comprehensive review of what is currently being placed on the web pages of various seed companies to see whether or not, in fact, what they're saying complies with or is in opposition to the Federal Seed Act. These specialists will not only look at the websites, but they'll also look at any pamphlets or PDFs that are advertised or mentioned or linked to these websites, and we'll call out circumstances and situations where perhaps that federal seed act is not being complied with.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more of the day's agriculture news. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, three components within USDA's Local Agriculture Market Program are now accepting applications for grant awards through May 14th. Rod Bain reports.
USDA Local Agriculture Market Program grant applications are now being accepted for the latest round.
The Agricultural Marketing Service is making available and announcing the funding availability of $24.7 million in grant funding through three of the LAMP programs.
That's Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs, Jenny Moffitt. She discusses the various Agriculture Marketing Service programs offering LAMP grant awards.
The Farmers Market and Promotion Program, the Local Food Promotion Program, and the Regional Food System Partnership Program, all administered by AMS. The goal is to support local and regional food systems as they develop, coordinate, and expand producer-to-consumer marketing, local and regional food markets, and local food enterprises as well. That can be things like supporting business plans, feasibility studies, value add, agritours, and figuring out what an agritourism plan might be for a region. The regional food system infrastructure, community collaboration, capacity building for things like farmers markets, as well as other capacity building within a region. It's about connecting and cultivating regional food systems.
In terms of details regarding applications for any or all of these grant programs,
applications are due May 14th. Potential applicants, anyone who's interested in applying, can go to the Agricultural Marketing Services webpage to learn more about these programs
at www.ams.usda.gov. While grant applications are to be submitted via www.grants.gov. Also, AMS has a turnkey option that is more standard and expands access for potential producer and organizational applicants.
Something new that we've instituted last year, really in response to some feedback that we heard about the complexity of applying for federal dollars. So we now have a turnkey option for several of the programs. And basically, if an applicant is looking to do specific activities related to recruitment and training or specific activities related to marketing and promotion, they can apply through this turnkey option, which is a smaller dollar amount, and it also is more standard in application. So that small producers, small organizations, people who are supporting new and beginning farmers and ranchers, historically underserved producers, veterans producers, and underserved producers at large can have the access to the program that is so important.
Additional resources for the Local Agriculture Market Program are available, such as the LAMP navigation tool via this web address, www.ams.usda.gov/services/grants/LAMP. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Friday's USDA supply and demand forecast created a small ripple in corn and soybean markets. Gary Crawford has more.
USDA's World Ag Supply and Demand Forecast on Friday had some interesting information, including another reduction in the prospects for the Brazilian soybean crop.
But I wouldn't say in general there are big shocks to this report.
USDA's chief economist Seth Meyer says it was along the lines of what was expected.
I think that there's a lot of interesting changes within this report, kind of, you know, making some changes in Argentina or Brazil with respect to, you know, corn and soybeans, and cutting global production for soybeans a little bit this month and cutting corn production a little bit this month as well, too, on a global level.
Right after the report was issued, corn and bean futures did go up slightly.
You're up a penny on corn. You're up 6 cents on beans.
But Meyer says he does not think this report would be enough to prompt a U.S. producer to change his or her plans for spring planting. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with the Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, U.S. pork exports race to a great start in the new year. January USDA data shows exports during the month were led by another strong performance in Mexico, the number one market for American pork. However, pork also made gains in other Western Hemisphere and Asia-Pacific destinations. Pork exports reached 241,424 metric tons in January, 6% higher than a year ago. Export value rose 6% to $682.1 million. Mexico's demand for U.S. pork is so spectacular that it can overshadow some of the other great success stories, says U.S. Meat Export Federation President and CEO Dan Hallstrom. U.S. beef exports were slightly behind last year's volume, but export value trended significantly higher. Beef exports totaled 99,764 metric tons, 1% lower than last year. Beef export value rose 9% to $763.8 million. January exports of U.S. lamb totaled 303 metric tons, up 28% from a year ago. In other livestock news, a positive trend for wool producers as the Australian market hit a hot streak in the recent series. Since this market sets the tone for global wool pricing, it's an important factor to watch. Recording a solid overall increase last week, the Australian wool market was driven by strong price rises in the merino fleece sector. The first selling day in the eastern centers, the market was mixed but overall positive. The second day opened as expected, then slowly but noticeably climbed as the sale progressed. All merino fleece micron price guides recorded increases between 7 and 26 cents. Though the EMI added 17 cents during the period, the average daily movement was only 3 cents, highlighting the recent stagnant nature of the market and providing a welcome spike in prices for producers. This week's quantity is forecast to rise due in part to sellers being encouraged to the market. As of Friday, there were 42,390 bales rostered nationally. In other livestock news, applications are open for the Angus Foundation's Commercial Cattlemen Scholarship, which awards four $1,500 scholarships to outstanding young people in the beef industry. This scholarship is unique from others offered by the foundation as it aims to support students specifically from the commercial sector of the industry. We're proud to offer this scholarship opportunity to students from commercial cattle backgrounds, says Jacqueline Boster, Angus Foundation Executive Director. We recognize the importance of supporting young people using Angus genetics and want to help them succeed in our industry. Students should be pursuing an undergraduate or vocational degree at an accredited higher education institution, and selection emphasis is placed on the applicant's knowledge of the cattle industry and their perspective on the Angus breed. Young men and women are eligible to receive the scholarship if they've transferred a registered Angus animal in or out of their herd in the last 3 years. I'm Will Jordan for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's Agnet West headlines, here's Agnet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
Pistachio growers may be best served in thinking critically about maximizing orchard potential when facing tough times. UC Cooperative Extension Specialist Brittany Goodrich highlights some of the considerations for growers to mitigate some of the economic challenges.
In these times where we have decreasing output prices while input prices seemingly keep rising, I really try and stress that we need to be focusing on profit maximization. So we don't need to be necessarily trying to maximize yield. Sometimes that is the profit maximizing strategy, but other times it's not, because you can keep throwing money into things and it's not necessarily going to pay off when you start actually calculating, you know, what that money that you're spending is worth in terms of yield. So really being critical and thinking critically about what you're spending money on is, I think, important.
Bayer's expanded one of its initiatives to offer more farmers incentives for adopting regenerative agriculture practices to sequester carbon and enhance soil health. Updates to the Bayer Carbon Program include expanded eligibility to more states and crops, extended historical performance periods, and a new nitrogen management program. Farmers can earn up to $12 per acre annually with potential increases through additional practices like nitrogen management. Unlike other carbon programs, Bayer's approach bases revenue on practices performed, reducing farmer risk. The program's renewal potential and simplified web enrollment aim to attract more participants. These enhancements aim to engage thousands more farmers, offering opportunities for increased revenue and simplified enrollment processes. The Bayer Carbon Program is part of Foreground by Bayer, which is a digital platform of resources and program options. The National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition released a report detailing the current landscape of the Farm Safety Net system. The report titled Unsustainable State of the Farm Safety Net analyzes the distribution of public funds in crop insurance, commodity programs, and disaster assistance from 2017 to 2022. Totaling over $142 billion, these funds primarily benefit the Midwest and Great Plains regions and are tied more to acreage than farm count or production value. Despite investments, small to mid-sized diversified farmers struggle to access relief during disasters. INSAC suggests reforms for a fair, functional, and informed farm safety net, emphasizing holistic risk management and on-farm resilience investments. The report's recommendations aim to guide lawmakers towards bipartisan policy reforms as Congress approaches the 2024 Farm Bill reauthorization. Researchers are seeking to better understand some dairy production practices through an industry-wide survey. Dairy Farm Advisor Jennifer Hege explained the goals of the project.
So we, University of California Cooperative Extension and UC Davis, have a project funded by the dairy industry through the California Dairy Research Foundation. We have two main objectives that we hope to accomplish. The first is to benchmark energy and water usage on California dairy farms. So data in this area is either very dated or non-existent for California. So the idea is really twofold. First, to document and take credit where recent modifications in practices have been made to increase efficiencies in energy and water usage, but also to set a benchmark to compare future progress. We know that, you know, progress is ongoing, so we really do want to have some metrics to compare to.
The Growmark Foundation's scholarship program will once again be providing 55 scholarships of $2,000 each. The Growmark Foundation will be providing scholarships to students pursuing agriculture and business-related degrees or certificates at colleges, universities, and technical schools in the U.S. and Ontario, Canada. At the time of application, students must be high school seniors or the equivalent, or continuing students in good standing that are enrolled at a university, community college, or technical school for fall of 2024. Applications are due April 15th, and scholarship recipients will be notified on May 15th. Scholarships will be awarded based on information collected in the application, including academic achievement, school and community involvement, and essay responses. More information on how to apply for the Growmark Foundation Scholarship is available at jobs.growmark.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Producers have until March 29th to enroll acreage in USDA's General Conservation Reserve Program. Rod Bain has more in today's This Land of Ours.
There is quick turnaround time for producers wishing to enroll acreage into USDA's latest Conservation Reserve Program general sign-up.
Enrollment for our general CRP is open until March 29th.
Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation Robert Boddy says regarding available acreage for total CRP enrollment.
Cap is 27.5 million acres. We're about 2.5 million acres, probably a little bit less than that, shy of the cap right now.
Interested producers are encouraged to contact their local Farm Service Agency office for more information about CRP acreage enrollment, and not just for the general sign-up.
We have other ways that acres will come into the program through our continuous enrollments where producers in certain designated areas can come forward and sign up, and then we'll have our grassland CRP.
The undersecretary adds this latest general CRP sign-up includes a Climate Smart practice incentive. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back. A family dream and community connections are behind efforts to produce and promote coffee from Hawaii, from the perspective of a mother and daughter coffee grower team. Rod Bain has more.
A mother-daughter duo producing coffee on the island of Hawaii, part of a greater community, creating greater economic and social opportunity. Mother Lori Obra and daughter Joan operate different companies, but with a shared dream fostered by Lori's late husband, Rusty, to promote coffee produced in the Kau district of the Big Island. And Joan Obra says when it comes to the building of that district's coffee industry among its members.
USDA has been really helpful with the different programs that have been available to farmers.
Assistance that has included a USDA socially disadvantaged groups grant for technical assistance and development for Kau's coffee cooperative.
These are programs that we do either as an industry or as a section of the industry. And so in that way, they also really do help build community and cooperation.
In that regard, Joan also granted set rights for USDA awards on behalf of her coffee-producing colleagues. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
There were no big surprises in the latest round of USDA crop forecasts. Here's Gary Crawford.
On Friday, right after USDA released its new global ag supply and demand forecast, projecting somewhat lower supplies of corn and soybeans, futures prices did make small gains.
Not insignificant, but not a large change.
USDA's chief economist Seth Meyer says soybeans gained about 0.5%.
Some of that might be a shrinking of the Brazil crop. But at the same time, when we look at overall global soybean carryout stocks, we did trim carryout stocks 2 million metric tons. And so the market could very well be taking a look at that and saying, hey, that's worth 6 or 7 cents.
Meanwhile, the report bumped corn futures up about 0.25%. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The nation's sugar producers spent time in Washington, D.C. last week promoting the economic benefits of the domestic sugar industry. Michael Clements reports.
The nation's sugar producers spent time in Washington, D.C. last week promoting the economic benefits of the domestic sugar industry. Nate Holtgren, a sugar producer from Minnesota, talks about his operation, which includes the fifth generation on the farm, his eldest daughter.
So our farm's located in Raymond, Minnesota. It's a small town west of Wilmer, Minnesota, which is a community of about 20,000. Raymond's only got about 700, 800 people in it. I farm with my brother Noah and my father Dwayne, raise about 1,500 acres of sugar beets. And we also raise corn, soybeans, alfalfa, sweet corn, peas, kidney beans, and then we have some beef cattle running about 7,000 acres today. We're also partnering a neighboring dairy here adjacent to our farm that milks 9,000 cows. My wife, Jamie, and I have 5 children, Lily being one of them. She's my oldest, and we're all raised here on the farm. It's not only a vocational choice, I guess, for my wife and I, but we chose the farm for the way of life that it provides. And then being able to raise our kids in the same way that I grew up is a real blessing to me.
Lily, as the daughter of a sugar beet farmer, shares her experiences on the farm that made her want to be a fifth-generation farmer.
Farming is and always has been an integral part of our entire family's way of life. And I just remember growing up and all seeing all the planning around sugar beet harvest and how it really is all hands on deck. And when your whole family and team work together to grow a crop and bring it to harvest, it's really an experience that brings a sense of pride and accomplishment and just brings us all together as a family. As for the memories that I have on the farm, one of the most distinct is that I used to ride along in the tractor cab when I was little and take some solid naps in there. But as I got older and just more capable, I grow to pick rocks and hoe weeds. But today I have quite a bit more responsibilities that provide some good value to our farm, and I'm just proud to be able to continue to work along in the family business.
Nate explains the Southern Minnesota Beet Sugar Cooperative and its importance to the rural community.
Yeah, Southern Minnesota Beet Sugar Cooperative is owned by local sugar beet farmers, so all the shareholders in that co-op produce sugar beets. From those beets, we produce high-quality sugar for consumers across the United States. We just celebrated our 50th anniversary a year ago. Our cooperative has a long history of providing good-paying jobs and involvement in our community, some pretty small towns in our area, but sugar beets are the name of the game. When the sugar co-op does well, these small towns do well. The small businesses on Main Street, whether it's selling pickups or farm equipment or even the grocery stores, the convenience stores, they all are very much based on the economy of these sugar co-ops.
Lily says there are several challenges facing sugar producers and all of agriculture.
All of agriculture is just facing the same economic pressures of high input costs. We're also seeing prices start to soften, which is of great concern to everybody, but it also presents an opportunity for policymakers. We just really want the ability to ensure the long-term sustainability of our operations. Like on our farm, we're constantly innovating and adapting to improve efficiency and reduce our environmental footprint, but we can't really ensure long-term viability on our own. So we do need federal policy to address the fact that there are foreign countries that are heavily subsidizing their sugar industries. But working together, I think farmers and policymakers can take steps to really ensure a strong domestic industry that is able to provide a reliable and affordable supply of domestic sugar.
Together, they shared their priorities with lawmakers in Washington.
Farm bill is obviously our top priority, hoping it gets done this year. But a strong farm bill is how we maintain a stable sugar policy that provides reliable safety nets, protects us from that unfair foreign competition that Lily was talking about. That was really the focal point of our discussions, and it will be over the next couple of weeks as we do these fly-ins to Washington. We do get that not everyone thinks of agriculture or sugar production every single day, but fly-in provides farmers the opportunity to remind these policymakers of the challenges and rewards of farming and its benefits to our nation. Our industry helps feed our country and plays a vital role in the economy, like I was talking about, with our rural communities, and it supports 151,000 jobs coast to coast. So we want to make sure people are aware of that.
Lily adds it's important lawmakers know the impact of the domestic sugar industry and the need to pass a farm bill.
Just kind of what I had mentioned earlier, there's a lot of economic pressures that we're up against. So it's really just more important than ever that we have the strongest safety net possible so that we're able to sustain current production levels necessary to invest in our supply chain and just to provide sugar to our customers, including all of the families across America. And we do recognize that Congress has a lot on its plate right now, but we just want to make sure whenever the farm bill does come up that it builds on the strong and stable sugar policy so that it continues to bring those benefits to producers and consumers as well.
Learn more on the American Sugar Alliance website, sugaralliance.org. Michael Clements reporting.
This is the AgNet News Hour, and we'll be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. For today's featured interview, we go back to Commodity Classic.
Okay, my name is Pat Clay. I'm the Product Development Manager for Herbicides for Valent USA.
Tell me, what is going on with Valent right now with herbicides, and what do we need to be thinking about in California?
Well, rice season's fast approaching, and it's tough. Weed controlling rice in California is tough. There's a lot of resistance issues, so stacking residual herbicides, having a good plan for post-emergence herbicides is essential. We have some great products that fit in that market to provide control of sedges and sprangle top with our foundation herbicides, Blair Ultramax, League MVP. And then coming in later in the season to do some cleanup operations against tough water grass or other weed species, Regimen is also a great option for managing those weeds.
So I don't know how much this is going to affect rice, but California has had some pretty wild weather this year. Is there anything that you would tell growers that they should watch for or be extra aware of because of that weather?
A couple of things. So first off, you know, the water reports will be coming out soon on how much water will be available, anticipating that it'll be near normal this year, so that's a good thing. Early in the growing season, with some wild swings in temperature, you really need to be cognizant of that in timing your foundation herbicides in the rice crop. So sometimes we've run into this in the past. You'll have a warm period, weeds start germinating, cools off, weeds stop germinating, and sometimes your residuals run out. So having a planned approach when those weather shifts are happening on stacking those residuals to get the best control is really critical.
Absolutely. You know, I want to talk about something that's important for all crops and all farmers, and that is sustainability. Tell me how Valent is looking at sustainability.
Valent's looking at sustainability in all kinds of ways, you know, not just around herbicide, but overall management of the crop. Have a great portfolio of sustainable solutions, whether it be biological products or conventional products that have a really good sustainable fit. So there's a lot going on in that arena across the board, multiple commodities.
So if you were to pick one thing that you really wanted our listeners to know about sustainability in Valent, what would that be?
Can I have a minute to think for that one thing?
Absolutely. And I'll let you talk about three or four if you want to.
For Valent, it's really about integrated solutions. So having multiple offerings that fit that sustainable acre. And it doesn't always have to be just a biological-based product. You know, mixing sustainable with conventional can have tremendous benefits in a lot of cases. So really just broadly pushing that message of sustainability out there is the number one key.
So for growers who are listening to this, how can they learn more and what should they do to take some first steps?
Talk to your PCA or advisor, They're going to have a good feel for, and have evaluated or know about these products in the marketplace, and not just products, but where to place them, how to use them to get the best results out of them. So really relying on your trusted advisor. Could be your, as I mentioned, the PCA. It could be your local Valent rep, University Extension, just gathering information on putting the products in the right position to win rather than just trying them out, maybe not seeing the result you want, and then moving on. Gathering that information to make a real informed decision on to get the best results.
So let's talk about Central California a little bit. Is that all right?
Yeah.
And some tree nut crops. What do tree nut growers and PCAs need to be thinking about now?
Well, we've had some wet weather during bloom. We're projected to have some more wet weather coming toward this weekend, and it looks like there may be a cycle forming up. Managing diseases is absolutely critical. No fungicide is a curative answer, and you have to really be on a preventative program. So coming in to manage brown rot or blossom blight this time of year is absolutely critical. So, you know, fungicides like quash or others with a similar mode of action are highly effective for that. And then if we move in past bloom and still are having these wet conditions, picking those fungicides is absolutely critical.
Yeah. You know, let's talk about preventive care. And is it too late at this point to be thinking about preventive?
It's not too late. It's really depending on where you are in bloom and what's happened in that orchard.
Right.
You know, the wet periods have not necessarily been widespread or consistent, I guess is the best way to say it. So, where you are in bloom matters, and then as you move out of almonds into some of the stone fruit and other crops that have yet to bloom, certain varieties have yet to bloom, there's still opportunities there to be really preventative in the care.
Does it help to have that little dry out period in between rain events, or is that almost worse, better or worse?
It's not better or worse. You know, once the disease gets going, it's probably there.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not better or worse. It's just bad.
It's just bad, all right. And that's fair. So let's say for growers who it's too late to really get into that preventive care and to really stop it before it happens, what can they do now?
Don't like using the term treadmill, but it's basically going to be multiple applications trying to prevent that disease from spreading further. So basically a planned approach, a timed approach, coming in every, depending on the chemistries you're looking at, anywhere from 7 to 14, maybe out to 21 days on the schedule, just trying to prevent that disease from spreading further and doing damage to the crop.
We'll be right back. You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. Now for more news, USDA and Department of Energy have a new initiative to encourage ag producers to apply underutilized renewable energy technologies on their farm. But what might be its benefit for growers? Rod Bain reports.
A new USDA Energy Department collaboration hopes to raise the use of underutilized renewable energy technologies among our nation's farmers. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says this effort has connections to existing USDA funding mechanisms for renewable energy, such as the Rural Energy for America, REAP program, and the Inflation Reduction Act.
To encourage embracing renewable energy. So one of the things we need to do is to make sure that farmers are aware of these opportunities. And so we recently announced resources for technical assistance for farmers so that they could understand and appreciate how they might be able to access a REAP grant or loan. We also agreed, if you will, to set aside a portion of resource that we were receiving under the IRA so that we could invest in underutilized technologies. So we set aside almost $145 million for that purpose, and we decided to talk with our friends at the Department of Energy, and could we coordinate an effort, and could we set a goal?
What the secretary was discussing during a recent visit with members of the Distributed Wind Energy Association was RAISE, the acronym for the Rural and Agricultural Income and Savings from Renewable Energy Initiative, and the goal mentioned by Secretary Vilsack.
Providing another 400 farmers across the country adopting distributive wind power. That'd be about a four-time increase in the number of distributive wind power projects we've funded in the past. And we're also going to identify some resources that will provide for entities to provide the technical assistance to encourage folks to participate in this initiative.
So what does this potentially mean for ag producers?
Between the REAP project and program that provides resources to the individual farmer and the tax credits, the technical assistance for REAP, combined with a grant opportunity under this underutilized technology fund, combined with the technical assistance resources that may be made available, we now are setting ourselves up for working in partnership to help farmers embrace renewable energy.
And beyond that, from an economic perspective,
if they can embrace renewable energy, the first thing they do is they lower their costs. The challenge here is to extend that idea beyond reducing their costs to figuring out ways in which these farmers can produce excess energy and then potentially work in combination with their neighbors who are also embracing a clean energy future to essentially coordinate their excess energy production and create the opportunity for that excess energy to be utilized by an REC now transitioning to a clean energy future. Now, instead of just reducing the cost of doing business on the farm, they're now generating a new source of income.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Farming is a risky business, which is why every farmer should speak with a crop insurance agent before the March 15th crop insurance sales closing deadline. Here's Michael Clements.
Tom Zacharias, president of National Crop Insurance Services, encourages all farmers, whether new to crop insurance or returning policyholders, to meet with their crop insurance agent as a first step and review all options for insuring their crops in the specific farm locations.
Farming comes with a multitude of risks, from unpredictable weather events and natural disasters to financial losses and crop price declines. This is why crop insurance exists. Crop insurance serves as the essential risk management tool designed to provide timely financial assistance to farmers when they need it the most. To keep up with the evolving needs of agriculture and farming, the crop insurance program is constantly improving and expanding, which is why we always encourage farmers to speak with a trained and licensed crop insurance agent before the crop insurance sales closing deadline.
Agents also help farmers navigate the multitude of crop insurance options, policies, and products available to develop a personalized risk management plan. Farmers should also discuss changes in their operation from the prior year.
Whether farmers are returning policyholders or new to crop insurance, an agent will be able to sit down with them to review all the options for insuring their crops for their individual operations. Starting with the basics, farmers need to make sure their policy is up to date. Have there been changes in the operation? Is all the underlying paperwork in order? Agents can then help farmers determine which risk management tools best fit their operations needs.
This past year, America's crop insurers worked in partnership with USDA to provide insurance coverage on a record 540 million acres, protecting almost $200 billion of crops and livestock on farms of all shapes and sizes. Local crop insurance agents, adjusters, and companies stand ready to quickly provide a helping hand to America's farmers and ranchers when it's needed. Michael Clements reporting.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.